All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And now time to switch over to the energy sector. It's a sector that unfortunately has kind of lagged the rest of the commodity markets as money's flown into commodities, but it's been more on the metal side of things, not so much on the energy side of things, or at least old school energy being oil and natural gas. Because we're talking oil and natural gas, we're chatting with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Now, Dan, let's just face this right on here. Oil has been trading in a very tight range for almost the last month, between $65 and about $69 on the crude price. And quite frankly, this is within, I guess, a trading range, but at the lower part of a trading range that it's been in for a couple years. What's your takeaway, Dan, from this relatively boring oil market?
Well, you may recall that when the tariff war started in March or whatever, whenever you announced that, they were talking about oil, you know, going down to $40 or something. So we at least got past that noise, because it really hasn't created much inflation. And it looks like they're going to be making some kind of deal with most countries eventually. I mean, I do wish they put some kind of end true deadline on this so that they can get going. But the big one's going to be China, you know, whatever they can agree to with China. But it looks like they're going to meet again next week. And I think they're moving towards something that's going to be reasonable, I guess. But anyway, so it's really just the fear of the trade war, because actually the oil market itself, the physical market, when you look out there, is really tight. I was just looking at a report today's Wednesday in the EIA report. U.S. crude oil inventories are 9% below normal. And I look at it's normal for where they should be based on the five-year average. And it's actually outside of the bottom of the range. It's not even within the range. It's never been this low this time of year, because actually this is the driving season. This is when we drain our crude oil inventories to produce gasoline and diesel, so summer blend transportation fuels. So in the physical market, you look out there and we should be in the 70s. And I think it's just this fear of the trading range, which fear of the tariff war is really a fear of recession. And if we would have a global recession, a true global recession, yes, you might see demand for oil-based products go down, but the numbers sure don't point to that happening.
Well, Dan, when you think about the oil market, I don't think we can extricate the OPEC situation, but also demand. I've seen a number of articles out saying that demand just wasn't as robust, not just in the U.S., but even in Europe this year as normal. So even though we're in the middle of summer driving season, it doesn't seem like the demand has been as much. So even if storage levels are down, if there's not that pull to market from demand, doesn't that still keep the prices muted?
Yeah, it's a mixed market, because seeing gasoline, now we are never going to be in any pressure on gasoline from like running out, because these shale plays produce really light oil that is perfect for making gasoline. And we actually have to export some of our light oil because we don't have enough refining capacity to handle it. Our problem in the U.S. is we need more black oil. We need Canadian oil and we need Venezuelan oil and, you know, whatever, so that we can make diesel. And the country runs on diesel. With all these big construction projects are announcing, you know, AI data centers and new manufacturing facilities moving here, they don't make those with things that run on electricity or run on gasoline. They make them on machines that run on diesel. So the diesel inventory as of, you know, when last week, the week ending, what was it, July 18th, the diesel inventory in the U.S. is 19% below normal, outside the bottom of the range. I literally have never seen it this low for this time of year, because, you know, diesel inventory, like gasoline inventory, really picks up in the middle of the summer. So that, from that fundamental standpoint, it looks really tight in the U.S. There's definitely no glut. And, you know, you look back to the pandemic, when the pandemic really shut down, you know, demand for oil-based products in early 2020, that immediately pushed inventories like to the max levels, and producers just had to shut in wells because there wasn't any storage capacity left over. But we certainly don't have that situation now. And then I was looking at a report this morning, and they don't even mention the Middle East anymore, the war over there. And then you start reading the highlights, the news articles and stuff, and you know, there was a Iranian helicopter went by a Navy ship and they're shooting off missiles again, and they're talking about not ending their uranium enrichment programs. So that war is not over. That war is not over. I mean, Team Trump is focused on the tariff wars right now, but I think, Israel's not going to allow them to start enriching that uranium again. So, anything can happen over there. And Iran is really isolated now from the rest of the world. So.
It is interesting to see how these ongoing wars don't seem to impact the oil price right now. But if we're going to look at those inventory levels, which you say are low or at least below the 5-year average, we do also have to look at U.S. production, which is remaining very strong, even with fewer rigs turning. Is that why low inventory levels aren't having an impact? Because the U.S. is producing so much?
Well, pretty soon you're going to start hearing the U.S. oil production is peaked and it's going on decline. There's no doubt about it. We aren't completing enough new wells. You can't just shut down the drilling rigs and expect production to remain flat. So I think by the end of the year, U.S. oil production is going to be off 500,000 barrels a day, less than what it, was in June. Over the last 6 months of the year, you're going to see a steady decline. We're just not completing enough wells. I mean, even the companies, some of the companies that I follow that are running rigs, they're because they have drilling contracts, they are completing the wells as far as running casing, but they're not perforating the wells and they're not hooking them up to, sales yet because they just, they don't want to sell these wells come on really at high rates and they don't want to sell that production into a low price market. So they go and we do have some of the rigs are moving over to the gas plays. I've heard there's a pickup in the number of gas rigs drilling in the Haynesville to get these higher prices. But in the futures market, if we and you guys ready to switch over to natural gas, because the natural gas market, I think we got a lot of paper traders out here, speculators that are getting stuck with long contracts and they're having to close at the end of the month. So
Yeah, Dan, let's switch to nat gas. I mean, it seems like between the two, between oil and nat gas, that nat gas actually has more potential excitement built into the latter part of this year as we move into the winter months. So what's your outlook on the gassers?
yeah, if you think oil price volatility is high, pull up a 1-year chart of natural gas. It's like all over the place. We've been way up into the mid fours and then we're down to like $3 again. But whenever you see these big moves in the futures market, what you're seeing is speculative traders. I call them paper traders. They cannot take delivery of the gas. So if they're long, if they don't close their contracts, they're going to get charged storage fees. Because they have to take delivery of the gas, and the guys that are can supply the gas to fill that contract, they're going to stick it in a storage location someplace, and they're so then these guys are going to start getting storage fees. And I've seen that happen when I was in public accounting. Some guys went long and they forgot to close their contracts, and next thing you know, they're getting invoices for big storage fees. So that's what causes at the end of the month, you get a lot of that where they have to cover their positions. Though they get a lot of these futures contracts are traded on margin anyway. And they're getting margin calls and they got to cover them.
What about stockpiles or inventories for natural gas? I've read some things that they are slightly above the seasonal norm right now.
Yeah, but they're above, when you look at the 5-year average, because they always go back to we're, 5 or 6% above the 5-year average for this time of year. But that's looking backward. I mean, the North American gas market, and this is going to be true in Canada as well, it is much bigger. There's much more demand for U.S. natural gas than there was 5 years ago. So that's a misleading thing. I say you need to compare it to where we were last year. We started the winter last year with gas in storage way above the 5-year average. And by the end of the winter, we had drained it below the 5-year average. So it's just a much bigger market. And you look at like these LNG export facilities, we had zero LNG export capacity back in 2015. And here we are with like 15, 16 BCF a day of export capacity. You got three big LNG export facilities that have just recently come online, one being LNG Canada. And that's demand. That's real demand. So between now and 2030, demand for U.S. gas, just U.S., not Canada, is going to go up by 5 or 6 BCF per day per year for at least the next 5 or 6 years. And there's other ones that are getting approval now to be built, beyond 2030. So it's just going to keep going up, up, up. And we lack the infrastructure. We've got massive gas reserve. North America has got almost unlimited natural gas reserves, depending on price. I mean, you just keep going deeper and you're going to find more gas. But we don't, you can't build these big long pipelines. You can't build pipelines from the Gulf Coast to the middle of the Permian Basin, 700, 800 miles. That doesn't happen overnight. So You got to do that, and then you got to have, processing facilities, compression, and everything have to be in place before you can take that, put those wells, online. So it's much tighter than just looking at where we are in the 5-year average. And plus, it has been mild. Like down, I live in the Houston area, and June and the first half of July has been relatively mild weather. I mean, we've had a ton of rain. I mean, you heard about the floods in the middle of Texas that killed all those people. Well, we've had a lot of rain in the Houston area. We don't get the flooding because it's, flat and just spreads out. And it's been cooler, but now it's back near 100 again. And with 108, on the heat index, 108, 110 or something every day. So my air conditioning is running full speed constantly. So we're going to get some better, more bullish looking storage reports here in August that I think will straighten this out. But I don't see gas being below 3. If it dips that low, that's just paper traders covering their positions. But I think, we could go back to 4. I mean, just again, look, bring the year-to-date chart, and you'll see how the volatility has been all over the place.
Well, Dan, you've also maintained in previous episodes that you thought by the end of the year, when we get towards the winter months, that gas could be pushing north of 4. And next year, a lot of the other analysts have, like a 450, 460 range for gas. What does that mean for the gas companies from an investment angle? People listening in, they want to know how they can capture some of these moves. So do you think that's still reasonable to see those higher prices by year end and next year? And what does that mean for opportunities in the nat gas stocks?
Yeah, like Range reported their second quarter results on Tuesday, the 22nd, and I just finished updating my forecast model for it. And they layered on a bunch of hedges at over $4 through 2027. And I think these gas companies would be smart to, whenever there is a spike in the gas price, lay on more, swaps and lock in those prices. So, and that's the thing from an investor standpoint. What you should do is make, not only look at the mix, production mix. All upstream companies produce a mixture of crude oil, natural gas, and natural gas liquids. And those markets are very, very different. And, these guys, if they can lock in that price, then they're really good. But boy, I tell you, beyond 2025, yeah, we're going to have enough gas. We're going to have enough gas in storage to make it through the 25, 26 winter. But it's the back half of 26 when I think it's going to really get tight, because you got even more LNG export facilities coming online. Golden Pass, Plaquemines is running up. I've got another 2 BCF a day higher. Golden Pass is a big 2 BCF a day facility. And LNG Canada is just phase one is about 2 BCF a day. And they're already pushing forward to double capacity up there to 4 BCF a day. So beyond 2025, it's starting to really, really look like it's going to be very difficult for supply to keep up with demand from all these LNG export facilities.
So, Dan, on the stock front, whether we look at XLE, the larger energy sector ETF, or individually some of the larger energy stocks, especially oil stocks, even something like ExxonMobil, these stocks are still doing okay. They're not really following the chart of the oil price. So, what's your assessment overall of, I guess, let's start with the large producers in the oil space?
Yeah, our Sweet 16 is really large cap, mid cap oil and gas companies that are. I just over the weekend, in the last couple of days, I've been going over my forecast models line by line, every one of them, comparing them to, first class and other analyst forecasts. They're all going to report, the oil price went down, everything went down in the second quarter, and they're all going to report positive earnings. They're going to report strong cash flow. Most of Every one of our Sweet 16 companies, based on my forecast, are going to be free cash flow positive in the second quarter, and that's going to be the worst quarter of the year. So they're looking really good for the second half, and they're very disciplined on their spending. They can, they most of their really good acreage is held by production now, so they can, drop a rig or two and live within cash flow if they have to for a while. But they're still, they're not making as much money as when we had $80, $90 oil. But at $65 oil, they're making a lot of money. I looked at like Range on an MCF basis. Their all-in cash costs are only like 30, 40 cents per MCFE. And then they're selling the gas for $4. So their profit margins are still really, really strong. And that goes for the oil producers too. The typical upstream oil company, I would say, has got cash operating expenses, including back office, G&A, operating expenses in the field, production taxes in the $12 to $15 per barrel range. So they're still very, very profitable. And as long as they got solid production, they're very, very cash flow. And they had a good year last year. The balance sheets are in much better shape. There's very few of the companies that have any near-term debt issues they can't, deal with. So, they're cut off from the capital market, and they're pretty much cut off from the debt market. So they know they're kind of on their own. And so they're being real frugal on how they spend their money.
Yeah, Dan, overall, the sector is much more prudent than it was, let's say, a decade or two ago. But you did bring up an opportunity that you see up in Canada with a company you want to feature, Whitecap Resources. It's traded on the TSX under the ticker WCP, and they've got a nice mix of oil and nat gas, and they have some fluids in their natural gas liquids as well. So, kind of a nice mix of different exposure to the space. What trips your trigger about Whitecap Resources?
Well, what I really wasn't covering it, but when they announced the merger with Veren, VRN, which is another Canadian company, that was one of my top picks in our Sweet 16. And that merger was announced in the first quarter, and they closed it on May the 12th. Yeah, May the 12th. So when they report their second quarter results, we're going to get our first real look at the combined, production and net income cash flow for the combined company. But it really, really looks strong. I mean, it's today's production is about 360,000 BOE per day. That's barrels of oil equivalent, 52.2% oil, 10.4% NGLs, and 37% 0.4 natural gas. And that's another thing. I like to see companies that have this good mix of production. So maybe the oil price will be a little bit down, but the gas price is way up year over year. I mean, the gas prices are up like 40 or 50% year over year. And the outlook for the fourth quarter for gas especially looks really good. And so there's one. And what I liked about it too is because I personally like to put my money in companies that pay big dividends. It pays monthly dividends. The yield based on the current price was just slightly over $10 Canadian is 7.2%. My price target is my valuation today is $13 Canadian per share, which is very close to First Call's price target is 12.83 Canadian. And I sent out a report on it to all of our members, and I said, hey, buy it now for the yield before the market really figures this thing out. But the long range, because of its tremendous growth potential, they're like now one of the fourth or fifth biggest producers in Canada, and they're going to end the year with over probably about 375,000 BOE per day production. That's a decent sized company. And they've got a lot of running room in two or three of Canada's best oil and gas plays.
So, Dan, is this a play where you would buy before we get the earnings report, or is it something that you would think we should wait for the earnings report, see the market reaction, make sure things are going as planned, and then move into that stock?
Yeah, I mean, you could go that route, but let me make sure. Okay. I mean, it's up today, really. I mean, here, yesterday is at 10:14 on Wednesday, and I think it's going to get a lot of coverage. For one thing, just the size of the company is going to, force more of the analysts to start covering it. And I think they're going to really like the numbers that they see, and they give real good guidance, a lot of detail. So it's easy. It was easy for me because I already knew what Veren was going to do. It's easy for me to create a pro forma forecast model for it, and which comes very much in line with what the current, tip ranks and First Call have. So I feel good about the numbers, and it's going to be very cash flow positive. It's going to generate close to 2.5 billion Canadian in operating cash flow. This is not a small company, and your listeners may not have heard about it, but this is a very large company that's got a lot of potential for us, I think.
Well, Dan, just another kind of follow-up on this is we've talked about a number of M&A deals over the last couple of years with you, and it seems like in the oil space in particular, there's this period of time where when two companies merge, it's more noticeable when it's a private company and a public merging. But even two public companies merging like this with Veren and Whitecap, there's like this period of time where the market doesn't quite know what it's going to look like pro forma, and then maybe a quarter or two later, the proof's in the pudding, and then all of a sudden there's a big jump in the stock. Maybe just highlight your strategy there about sticking with the pro forma company because of this period of like uncertainty and then the realization a couple quarters later.
Yeah, and I think what the number one thing that I do for our members is I think we give them good conservative, pro forma forecast models. And yeah, if you know what a company's going to look out look like when they have their first full quarter after an acquisition, that's going to help you beat the market because you've got data that's, a lot of the analysts are too lazy to figure out, for one thing, and a lot of, investors that don't run because they do like you said, they don't really know, okay, what's G&A going to do? What are the expenses going to do because of this merger? And most of the time, especially when you have two mergers of companies like Whitecap and Veren, because of the size of their companies. And the other thing is the synergy of the exploration people, like the engineers, geologists, and stuff. A lot of times that's a big plus that's overlooked. When you put those teams together, you end up with, two heads are better than one, or I guess of how to look at the wells and the drilling completion methods and stuff like that. And I think that's where you see a big benefit of the synergies when you get into the next year. The 2026 on this looks really good. My 2026 forecast is 3.3 billion in operating cash flow, and it looks good. And I think the Canadian dollar firming up against the US dollar is another reason why we like some of our Canadian companies better than the US companies at this point. And they were overlooked. I mean, they were really trading at low multiples, until just recently, anyway.
So, Dan, as we look maybe to some other stocks, what do you think the market cares more about? Is it growth or is it sustainable production at preferably lower quartile costs?
Yeah, I think, investors get in this their first time. They should be looking at, okay, what does the balance sheet look like? Do they have any debt problems? And I've got a couple of my small caps that, yeah, they do. Since they don't have access to the capital markets and they can't raise any more equity, they're just stuck. They got to pay down their debt. So all their free cash flow is going to debt payments, and that's not very attractive to investors. But, leverage does work both ways. That's another thing. If you do get oil, like it spikes up to 80, where I think is kind of the right price, actually, these things now look really, really attractive because they're generating a lot more free cash flow and they can start paying dividends. And actually, the biggest gains I've ever made personally is on little Canadian companies. Hemisphere is one of them, where I can see that in a year or two, they're going to be able to start paying dividends. And from talking to CEOs and stuff, I can tell that's their plan. They want to start paying dividends. So if you can get into these small caps, and I think I got into Hemisphere at under 20 cents, and now it's like a buck 20 or something. And then when they start paying dividends, then you get a whole new layer of investors that will only invest in companies that pay dividends. And that's where I've gotten some of my biggest capital gains is on those small cap companies.
Dan, do you ever play the small cap or some of the growth ones with the idea that they're takeover targets?
Yes, I definitely do. And that's what I used to do for Hess. We were out looking at public companies for takeover targets, and my team, we closed three really big deals and a bunch of small deals that were up to like $3.5 billion in acquisitions, which in today's dollars would be like $8 billion. But yeah, if you can find some of these companies, perfect example of that was Earthstone. Earthstone, I knew the management team. These guys were building that company through acquisitions. And one day they announced a takeover by Permian Resources, took them over. And I love Permian Resources. It's going to be a real strong company. It's like number one in the Delaware Basin, which is the western half of the Permian Basin. And when you combine those companies' assets and they jump to like 350,000, which is very similar to this Veren Whitecap thing, now you've moved to a different level. And the bigger companies, size matters in this business. And when the bigger companies, they just instantly deserve higher trading multiples. Like you got some of these smaller companies like Hemisphere, they're basically trading at what their proved developed producing reserves is if they're not going to have any future production growth at all. Because the sustainability, if you look at Whitecap, you see what's their long range business plan, and they lay it out. Do they have the cash flow? Do they have access to capital to make that happen? And they also, because of their size and their strength of their balance sheet, they do have access to capital if they can come up with a good takeover target. They have no problem funding those deals. And that's how the great growth stories of the US, which is one is Diamondback Energy, classic example. They started doing that, got into a good period of time, were able to just start, building through these acquisitions, bang, 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 increasing their production by 50, 60% year after year after year. And then suddenly the Wall Street gang just loves them. And they're trading at a high multiple. So yeah, the M&A market is starts to really pick up, and it probably will. It also picks up as you head into year end. Usually you see some deals that are made so they can get them closed before the end of the year.
All right. Well, Dan, you gave us a lot to think about and look at within the energy sector. And hey, sometimes when markets are boring, it's the best time to take some positions, especially when we do see this environment of commodities and resources continuing to do very well. That money very easily can rotate into some of the lagging sectors. It just comes down to time-wise. But again, slow markets can be a good time to position yourself. I just find it interesting that some of the big boys in the oil space, they're still doing quite well, even in this generally lower price oil and natural gas
And
environment.
I'd just like to say, if any of your listeners want to see our recent report on Whitecap, it's about a 15-page report. Just have them send me an email, energyperspectus@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to share that report with them.
There you go. I'll even post your email address within the show notes on our website, podcast, and YouTube channel. Dan, thanks for your time on this weekend show. Everyone, thanks for tuning in this weekend. Thanks for spending some time with us. Hope you all found this weekend show valuable. And please go back through the week through our website, podcast, Substack, and YouTube page to listen to all the daily editorials and company updates from this last week. There were a lot of them because there's, quite frankly, just a lot going on in the resource sector. It's a bull market, so now's the time to really gear up and hopefully take advantage of it. Everyone, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.